Why do we drink what we do? Why do some drinks become classics while others languish at the back of the drinks cabinet?
Is it just because we prefer those drinks, or are there underlying economic, social, or technological trends that shape our choices?
And that's what we're going to explore on A Question of Drinks.
Join us as we explore the hidden side of the drinks cabinet, the decisions, reversals, and underlying forces that shape the beverage market. I'm Luli Halstead.
And I'm Felicity Carter. And together we host A Question of Drinks. Luli, we made it.
We did, Felicity. We've done a whole year of A Question of Drinks. And do you know, three people have sent me their Spotify Wrapped 2025 podcast list because A Question of Drinks appears in their top five podcasts for 2025.
What? Why didn't somebody send me one of these? I definitely need better friends. Present company accepted.
But
you're going to have to tell me what it actually means.
Okay, so it means that once people have started listening, basically they become fans and keep coming back to it week after week, and we get extreme loyalty, therefore.
So I think that's good, except having done this podcast with you for a year and talked about Ehrenberg Bass's research, wouldn't they say we need more casual listeners?
Absolutely. You're spot on there. Yeah. So we've built disproportionate loyalty before scale, in other words.
Disproportionate loyalty. We love all of you, but there's not enough of you. Bring your friends to
us. Yes.
All right. So meanwhile, I'm going to take it that this makes 2025 a landmark in drinks history. This is the year we launched what will no doubt be considered a future classic of drinks podcasting.
Okay. That's somewhat a bigger claim than the announcement suggests, as much as I'm pleased about it, though.
Yeah, well, you're the woman who's been dubbed never knowingly under-opinionated, so I'm going to become the woman who's never knowingly under-delusional.
Okay. Yes, you can claim that one, but I've got no idea if is that a good thing or not?
It's a bit like 2025 in drinks. It's a year that's been all over the place.
Oh, yes, exactly. Okay, yeah. So 2025 has truly been the year that's tested the limits in all directions in drinks. So now I need to ask you, did you follow the brief for this episode and bring some stories that particularly stuck out to you over the year?
Oh, of course I did. Were you doubting me?
Me? No, you never. No, not at all, Felicity.
Just because I do things at the last minute doesn't mean I don't get them done.
You said it, not me. So today's question, let's keep us on track. So today's question, the theme is the questions are, what have been the top stories in drinks in 2025?
All right. So speaking of the brief, I won't claim that my stories are the top ones,
yeah,
but they're definitely the ones that interested me the most. So why don't we start with some genuinely big ones and then we'll move on to my maybe less big ones.
Okay. That sounds good. So shall I go first then with one of mine? Okay. So one of my top picks for the stories, and I guess this is really a set of stories for 2025, is one that proves how panicked the drinks industry has become.
Oh.
And it's the M&A.
Still a bummer.
M&A frenzy that we've seen. So clarification here, I'm not saying frenzy because there were tons of deals in the drink sector. There weren't. But if we look at Capstone Partners, who monitor deals and acquisitions, we saw 98 deals in the broader beverage sector, which is actually down just over 12% on last year in terms of number of deals.
98? I would have thought the alcohol sector was more dynamic than that.
Yeah, I hate to tell you, but that's also covering all beverages, so not just alcohol. To be fair, so Capstone are only capturing some of the deals, and it primarily includes sort of the bigger ones and the ones they're measuring consistently year over year. So they're using a consistent methodology. So what we can see is the trends in terms of the types of deals, the M&A happening in drinks.
Well, I'll tell you what, that shows you how you shouldn't believe social media. So every time I log on, I read about somebody making a ton of money by selling their beverage company.
Yeah, I'm not sure how true those stories are.
Yeah, because apparently not.
The reality is quite different. So Capstone's numbers include alcohol, but as I was saying, but also a chunk of kind of soft drink and no and zero. But here's the kicker, okay? So the deal value is way up. So I was just saying there, the number of deals down, but the deal value up. So the average check is enormous. And according to Kroll's 2025 analysis, 76%, so three quarters of deals were strategic buyers, i.e. businesses, rather than private equity, i.e. investment buyers. So we could say that when the elephants are rearranging the furniture, something has gone wrong in the category.
Okay, I have to say, I would never say the elephants are rearranging the furniture, but what okay. I'm taking, that's a really interesting metaphor. But what I'm taking away from that, if I understand it correctly, is that these deals aren't necessarily healthy. They're a sign of panic-driven consolidation.
Yeah, exactly. And we're talking billion-dollar, effectively, musical chairs here.
All right. So one I know off the top of my head is PepsiCo bought Poppy for something like nearly $2 billion.
Correct, and that's,
Now, we don't get that in my market, but it's a prebiotic soda that everybody I see claims cured their gut and their personality. And it sounds disgusting, but it's very popular.
Very, very popular. Yeah. And then there's Celsius, for example, snapping up Alani Nu for, again, just shy of $2 billion. So that's a female-focused energy drink, effectively selling faster than skincare serums on TikTok. So we could view this as not being kind of strategic growth opportunities, which is how they are certainly presented to their shareholders and to the market, but more like kind of panic buys, you know, sort of wearing expensive PR outfits effectively.
So I guess we could add the acquisition of Beatbox to that. Mm-hmm. So beer giant AB InBev bought an 85% stake in the wine-based RTD as part of their strategy to move beyond beer, which is an interesting strategy for a beer company.
Well, yes, and that's driven, I'm imagining, because in the US, beer is basically flat to declining and has been for years. And if we look at analysts' IWSR, they say that any life in the category, in the beer category, is coming from craft and flavoured beers, but overall, all Americans, especially younger drinkers, just aren't drinking more beer.
Yeah, well, obviously AB InBev is taking action about this because they've also formed a global partnership with Netflix so they can do product placement and limited edition packaging and things like that.
Yeah, exactly. So they're on the hunt for basically new ways to connect with consumers given what's going on in the market.
Right. So from beer, we should talk about spirits merger and acquisitions because that was wild too.
Yeah, yeah, of course. So again, IWSR has been very clear. Tequila last year and this year, 2025, is one of the only major spirits categories that's still showing global value growth. Everything else is barely limping forward. So if we take some of the spirits giants, Diageo, Bacardi, Constellation, they're all buying. But because who in their right minds would try to build brands in 2025?
Well, it's funny you say that about tequila because speaking of Diageo, tequila wasn't so great for them.
Ah, yes, yes. So Diageo, the cautionary tale of 2025, perhaps.
Yeah, so from what I understand, the problem was Diageo bet too heavily on tequila. They pumped way too much product into Latin America after the pandemic. They flooded the market and then everything froze because distributors were drowning in stock.
Yeah, while at the same time, consumers were pulling back on their spending. So when the sell-through didn't match the spreadsheets, effectively, the whole region buckled. Profit warning, share price collapse, analysts saying words like misjudgment and one of my personal favourites, inventory overhang.
Inventory overhang. It's like, I don't know, that's like collateral damage.
Yes.
And so, and then what, speaking of collateral damage, and then what happens was we got this corporate Game of Thrones. Every morning I'd read an analysis of the drinks industry and there'd be sort of more insights into the boardroom at Diageo. So we got the CEO resigning, the CFO was out, all these regional heads quietly disappeared.
Yeah, exactly. And things are very tough at Diageo. So just to remind ourselves, Diageo, headquartered in the UK, are one of the world's largest alcoholic drinks companies with over 200 brands. So that's primarily spirits, but also beer and RTDs, selling in more than 180 countries. And they're powered by five global giants. So Johnnie Walker, Guinness, which we've talked about a lot on this podcast, Smirnoff, Don Julio, and your favourite, Baileys.
Yes, Baileys is an awesome product. And just to be clear, if Diageo would like us to help them out and give Baileys a lift, give us a sponsorship. And let me reiterate, we would cherish it. We would put lots of pictures of us drinking Baileys all over social media. We would do a great job.
We would, yes. And we have to keep the awareness up for our Baileys sponsorship campaign. So building mental availability for them to sponsor us. But anyway, back to Diageo. Yes. So they've just appointed Sir Dave Lewis, better known as Drastic Dave in the press. So the turnaround specialist who rescued Tesco after its accounting scandal. So he's famous for ruthless cost-cutting, brutal simplification and dragging failing business back to profitability, which kind of tells us exactly what DHO thinks they might need right now.
I wonder how his parents felt when they read the newspaper one day and found out their son was called Drastic Dave. And what's interesting is he got that name because I think it was Tesco he turned around Unilever as well. So Tesco's at the value end of supermarkets in the UK. And so what it may indicate for Diageo is the era of betting everything on premiumization might well be over.
This also tells you why everyone went shopping for drinks businesses. The signals were flashing that there were basically bargains on the table.
Yes, and this year also saw a couple of fire sales.
Okay, fire sales, Felicity. That sounds more like an expression I choose in my somewhat understated British tone. After a year of podcasting together, I'd expect more from you, Felicity. What do you really mean by that?
I don't know, desperate sell-off, retreat from the market, flogging at a discount, brand dumping, what would
okay,
you want it to
be? That's so much better. That's so much more you. Okay, or to put it, we could put it another way, Pernod Ricard offloaded Imperial Blue, so one of India's biggest whiskies.
Then Campari sold Cinzano and Frattina for 100 million euros to Cafo Group, who immediately said this was their international expansion moment. And by the way, Campari reportedly may need the money because they allegedly, according to some media reports, owe the Italian government 400 million euros in back taxes.
Okay. So we were just talking about Diageo not having a kind of great day either or great year either. So first they dumped some of their rum and Safari and some of their other brands. But you know, one of the most surreal moments, I think, in drinks in 2025 was Diageo basically trading brand rights, effectively like kind of Pokemon cards. And the brand they handed over, Ciroc.
Oh, wow. That used to be one of their crown jewels.
Yeah, exactly. So a billion-dollar cultural icon, the vodka, of the 2000s. And now it became so toxic between the Diddy lawsuit drama and the 32% reportedly sales crash in 6 months, Diageo basically decided getting out was easier than fixing it.
So they just swapped it.
Yeah, effectively. They traded the North American rights to Ciroc in exchange for more control over Lobos 1707 Tequila, the brand backed by LeBron James.
God, that is like trading Pokemon cards.
Yeah, exactly. And it tells you everything about the moment we're in. So if a brand isn't earning or it's growing or it's causing PR migraines, so the new rule is simple, basically, in 2025, cut it loose and double down on whatever still has a pulse.
All right. Speaking of pulses, actually, pulse has nothing to do with my next topic, but do you want to talk about whiskey?
I do. You know, I always want to talk about whiskey because it's one of my favourite drinks. And do you remember it featured in my last year's Christmas tree theme,
I
remind you?
Yes, I do remember.
So Edrington sold this year Famous Grouse, so the 125-year-old brand that's, you know, sort of Scotland's supermarket favourite to William Grant & Sons. Why? Because Edrington wants to be the ultra-premium only. So we could do a translation. If you're not earning enough per litre, goodbye, effectively.
Yeah, didn't one of the Rabobank analysts actually say this? Like, quote, brands that don't earn enough per litre must go.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
All right, so that's spirits. Do we dare look at what happened in wine in terms of M&A and transfer of brand and business ownership?
Oh, yes, let's do that. So let's start with the headline business transaction for wine in 2025, the coming together of Pernod Ricard and Accolade, merging their wine businesses into a monster called Vinarchy. I'm never quite sure how to say that. It's absorbed brands like Jacob's Creek, Campo Viejo, Brancott Estates and Hugo, etc.
Can I just say, Vinarchy is quite the name for a corporate entity that is anything but anarchic. Anytime I've met one of their people, and I have met their people, they're wearing a suit. Though it just occurred to me, maybe the portmanteau word is actually monarchy, in which case that's stupid too. It's a silly name. Sorry, let's move along.
Yeah, well, one I'm still working out how to pronounce pronounce, but of course we know my pronunciation is definitely not my finest area. Anyway, to put them into context, they produce about 120 million bottles a year. And this is why the drinks business called it the mega deal of 2025.
Look, when you're up against unpronounceable names, what you should do is you should just pronounce it the way you want to and then make that the standard, all right? So
okay.
I'm going to call it Vinicky. So Vinicky announced they're cutting 60 wine brands, which equates to about 50% of their portfolio. Yeah. So they said they're going to focus on lower alcohol formats and what they're calling, quote, youth-friendly products.
Yeah, and by the way, that's exactly what I would have done. So no wine producer should be managing over 120 wine brands.
Yes, I saw, one of your rants about this on LinkedIn, Luli.
Felicity, as I've said to you before, the gift of sharing and discourse, it's not ranting. Anyway, if we're staying in the world of wine, there's Simi Winery, which somehow managed to get sold twice this year,
Yes, and the second time it was bought by a group called, and I did not make this up, the group was called War Room Sellers. How is that for an image of a beleaguered sector?
Exactly. It tells you everything about the mid-tier wine market. Nobody wants to hold the assets for more than 5 minutes in case the value drops on the walk back to the car.
Yeah, musical bottles.
Yeah, and far fewer wineries.
Yes. So in addition to Simi, the wine group snapped up Woodbridge, Myomi, Mondavi Private Selection, Cooks and J. Roger from Constellation, plus vineyards and facilities. And so Constellation CO pretty much all but said, we're keeping the expensive stuff and, you know, you can have the rest.
So talking about wine, let's not forget Treasury Wine Estates and Dow.
Oh, Dow, yes. Just 2 short years ago, it was big news that they had paid nearly $1 billion for the luxury winery Dow in the USA.
Yeah, they did. And it didn't turn out so well, Felicity.
No, it didn't. The financial press recently reported that not only did they pay way too much, but they're facing a, quote, 11% annual reduction in future cash flows in its American business, which I think is the accountant's way of saying sales are dropping.
Yeah, I think I would agree with you on that. And we could go on. There are other examples of mergers and sales, but there's one number that sums up the underlying problem going on here. $830 billion.
That's a number big enough to make the people at Treasury feel a little bit better.
It is. And here's the really ugly bit. So according to Bloomberg, about $830 billion of market value has vanished from publicly listed alcohol companies since 2021. So their global drinks index is now 46% below its peak, you know, and we've been discussing them, Diageo, Pernod Ricard, Remy Cointreau, all tracking at decade lows.
Oh my God, it's a bloodbath. Luli, you're the analyst. Why is everything collapsing at once?
Okay, so there's a few fundamental shifts that we've seen. I probably up there as number one, I would say, is consumers, including but not restricted to Gen Z, are drinking alcohol differently. So primarily less frequently, and that's what's overall driving down alcohol volumes in certainly the mature and established markets.
Yeah, I think cost of living is absolutely number one. But we've also got multiplying health warnings and an anti-alcohol lobby. And there is some evidence, it's not that powerful yet, but there are some signals that the proliferation of Ozempic-like drugs are beginning to make a difference, as is cannabis in some markets.
Yeah.
Though I have to say the impact of the last two is hotly debated.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the jury's definitely out and the evidence is definitely out on those currently, and we'll see as those two categories, those two markets mature. But what is true is that consumers are currently, to your point about economics that you just chimed in with there, are exhausted by premiumization. They're not paying $40 for something, you know, that was $25 last year.
Yes, as a friend of mine said, when everybody premiumizes, you don't get premiumization, you get inflation.
Yeah.
It's a different thing. So what do you think? Is it a blip?
No, with a little bit of yes.
Oh, how very helpful of you. Do you want to explain what you mean?
Okay, so the yes bit. So we have, as consumers, developed a different relationship with alcohol consumption. But a lot of this change is also driven by your point in 2025, which is the economic conditions. So we can see in the data from IWSR, for example, that there's a lack of the availability of money to spend, discretionary spending, and that's having the biggest impact in terms of the reduction of the levels of alcohol we're consuming over and above the sort of drive towards health and wellness.
Yes. So the big question that everybody's been talking about this year, everywhere I go, is Is this change structural or is it cyclical? And the answer is beginning to look like it's structural.
Mm.
Okay, so we have really been in the weeds here. Can you sum up 2025 in terms of business transactions and M&A?
I will give it a go. So M&A used to be growth strategy. What we've seen in 2025, if it's basically become survival. Buy what's working, sell what's dying, cut the losers and run.
God, you're really getting everybody in the mood for Christmas here, Lily.
Okay, well, you did Blimey. Ask me for my top stories.
I'm just thinking about the wine in my fridge and whether I open it tonight or not. I think okay. I need it.
Sorry. So 2025 was the year the industry, stopped pretending everything was fine.
You've got any good news under your lovely ombre tree?
Okay. Yes. Okay, yeah, I'll do some better news. So one of my favourite stories, or again, set of stories of the year, is one that says so much about where drinks culture is heading. So this is the rise of celebrity zero alcohol brands. So let's just take one example of this. So Lewis Hamilton, the British racing car driver.
Actually, this links really nicely back to our previous episode on authenticity in drinks, and in particular, the concept you introduced of founder authenticity, where the founder's identity has to be congruent with the drink's identity.
I know, as if we planned it, Felicity. So exactly, meaning if you're known in his case, in Lewis Hamilton's case, for driving really, really, really fast, probably not best to be associated with alcohol.
Yeah, right. That's right. So Hamilton co-founded Almave, is that how you pronounce it?
I think so, yeah.
A distilled non-alcoholic agave spirit. It uses real agave and it comes in a nice blue bottle.
He did. And then this year he launched Almave Humo, so basically a mezcal-style non-alcoholic mixer drink with really kind of proper smoke and structure flavours, so sort of replicating that flavour of mezcal.
And does that come in a nice bottle?
It does. It is. But it's kind of the brand is signalling something bigger, sort of the glamorous end of drinking culture is drifting towards premium non-alcoholic. So the flavour, the rituals, sophistication without the hangover effect.
Okay, this is my opportunity to sneak in an extra story.
Okay, is it based on a story that you wrote by any chance?
No, actually, this is one I just observed unfolding. Oh, okay. So in November 2025, the EU rules that non-alcoholic drinks cannot be called gin. The implication for the whole category is that non-alcoholic drinks are going to have to stand and fall on their own merits and not as the alcohol-free versions of existing drinks.
So I think that might have mattered probably more than a year ago. But the non-alcoholic space has grown so rapidly that these drinks kind of now are standing on their own. So the rush of celebrities into the category strongly signals that, I would say.
Speaking of which, shall we talk about Kylie, the Australian pop star headquartered in the UK?
Absolutely. We always need to talk about Kylie. I will and forever will be such a fangirl of hers. So quick aside, can I do one now?
Of course.
Thank you. So I was a client I was working with last week brought up Kylie's wines at a board meeting we were at, and she was using it as a case study of success. So I chipped in at the board meeting, you know, sort of nodding, you know, with the groundbreaking statement, I agree, you know, to which the client replied, I thought you might sing as I learned about that on your podcast. Oh, can you believe that?
Hello, Luli's client, a person of excellent taste and discernment.
<Thank you.
laughs> So speaking of Kylie, I was around when the Australian press used to call her the singing budgie.
And they didn't. No, did they really?
Yeah, they did. And she stood at a microphone once and she said, singing budgie, up your bum. She was really upset. But they're all very respectful now, according to industry reporting. She's sold millions of bottles since she launched her rosé and she's now exporting to more than 30 countries.
Yeah, but here's the bit that most people miss about this, which is the Kylie Zero range, so the zero alcohol wine, still and sparkling, are some of the fastest growing parts of her portfolio and really dominating those categories, the zero categories.
And of course, we have to make the point for anybody who doesn't already realise this, that she does not make the drinks herself.
No.
She works with Benchmark Drinks in the UK, which is pretty much, I think you could say, it's a celebrity drinks agency.
Yeah, so they've kind of morphed into that, yeah.
I mean, they've got Graham Norton, they've got all sorts of people. So they have huge expertise in this celebrity space. So she didn't just wake up and do a rosé.
No. But what she's bringing
maybe
is...
maybe she did. Maybe I'm making an assumption.
If you speak to the team at Benchmark, they do say that she is involved in the blending and how the wine actually tastes.
Do you speak to the team at Benchmark?
I do.
So you're like... 2 degrees of separation from Kylie.
I know. Maybe one day I'll actually get to meet her in person.
That's awesome.
I'll clam up and I won't be able to say anything because I'll be fangirling. Anyway,
Don't bring up the singing budgie. Yeah, sorry.
Yeah. What she brings is brand equity and brand awareness. So kind of aspiration, accessibility, inclusivity, and that's really important as part of her brand. And it works because that's Kylie. So she's kind of reflecting that and she can basically make anything chic and aspirational.
And also she's fun. She's seen as pretentious.
Yeah. And she's not the only one leaning into this founder authenticity. See that? Can link back to our previous episode.
Yes, you're clever.
Getting it in there. So you've got, you know, Bella Hadid with Kin Euphoric. So that's a botanical, functional, wellness adjacent drink. Tom Holland with his non-alcoholic beer. You know, there's so many examples. But the pattern's really clear. It's not the wild party celebrities jumping into traditional alcoholic drinks anymore. It's the brand builders, people with this sort of lifestyle, fame, credibility, and they're choosing low and no alcohol drinks on purpose.
Because that's where they can see the growth.
Exactly. And the non-alcoholic category is growing whilst most alcohol segments are flat or failing. And when celebrities kind of smell this cultural movement, they pounce. Kylie with her wine, for example, Lewis Hamilton with the agave. The rest, the wellness elixirs that we've been talking about.
Yeah, for what it's worth, I do think this is an interesting cultural moment, but it could go one of two ways. This is either going to turn into a mature category or it will prove it was beyond meat all along and most players will drop out.
Yeah, exactly. It could go that way. And it shows that there's a big cultural shift, however, underway at the moment, that celebrities are staking their brands on wellness and getting behind these beautifully branded adult drinks in 2025.
So basically, celebrities follow the money and the money has moved.
Exactly. And if celebrities follow the money, marketeers follow the celebrities and the whole industry shifts. So the future, I would say, is sober-ish, premium and beautifully lit.
Maybe. We should revisit this next year. So, you know, non-alcoholic drinks still have to get some kinks ironed out, particularly the amount of sugar that so many of them use.
Yeah, and of course, they're typically quite expensive because blending something that gives you the feel and the weight of alcohol without the alcohol in it isn't easy to do. So, Felicity, now it's your turn for stories. What stood out for you in 2025?
Okay, what do you know about Liquid Death?
I know some things about Liquid Death. So it's the American canned water launched in 2019 and known for its heavy metal punk branding and humour. So it's sold in tall aluminium cans, again, with lots of humour. And their tagline is "Murder Your Thirst."
Huge success. It turns up all the time as a sort of great founding story of a rags to riches story born because somebody was smart. It was founded by graphic designer Mike Cesario, who wanted to make water cool.
And it literally flew off the shelves using a sort of entertainment first strategy. So by being funnier effectively than anybody else in the water category, which I guess isn't that hard to do, and partnering with the entertainment industry so that they got initially served at concerts. So that was their sort of entry in, category entry point. Ah, got category entry points in Felicity.
Well done. Yay. Well, so I'm always interested in the money. And as of this year, they're worth $1.4 billion.
Okay, so you bought them up. So what happened that was so interesting? Was it about how and where they made their money?
No. It's because they had a catastrophic failure right on your doorstep, Lily. They tried to move into the UK market and they bombed so badly they had to withdraw in March 2025. Yes. Their money did not save them.
Yeah, of course they did. So what, in your analysis, what do you think went wrong, Felicity?
Okay, I just want to ask you one question.
Okay.
What water do you buy for your personal drinking?
Well, I am the wrong person to ask because I don't buy bottled water because I just fill up my water bottle from the tap.
Well, that's it. That is the reason they failed in the UK. They didn't look at what people were actually drinking before they turned up. Many, many people in Britain think their tap water's pretty good.
Yeah, which most of the time it is, which is why I do exactly that. Unless, like my friend, and she is a friend of the podcast friend, by the way, who lives in the Southeast England, last week indeed was one of, get this, 24,000 households that was without water in the UK for 5 days. And when it did come back, they had to boil it because it wasn't safe to drink.
So your friend's been living on tea since then. That's terrible.
Yes, I know. I know. Well, we are British. That's sort of okay. Anyway, so what was the reason for liquid death's failure? Was it just that we don't really drink that much bottled water? Because I see loads of bottled water in the supermarkets.
Well, so liquid death sells itself as the sustainable option because they're in aluminium, which can be endlessly recycled rather than plastic bottles, which can't. The problem is filling your glass from the tap is way more sustainable, again, if sustainability is what you care about.
Yeah, and also I'm wondering whether the high cans, so they're taller cans than we typically see in UK shops, were a mistake because it's not the size that we're used to.
Yep, that was a problem. And so was the bright heavy metal branding, which British shoppers associate more with energy drinks.
So I guess my biggest question also would be about price. I never purchased it because I said I don't buy bottled canned water. So do you know how much they were selling it for in the
UK? I do. £5 for a 4-pack. So for Americans, that's about $9 for a 4-pack.
What? I could get like 8-pack of Highland Spring bottles for £3. Not that I do, clearly, and no offence to Highland Spring, of course, but that seems like an enormous amount of money to pay for water.
That's right. Or you could just keep using your tap.
Yes, which I will continue to do. So the moral of the story is spend time in your export markets before you invest in them. There's lots of stories, aren't there, about companies going into new markets, drinks companies, but all sorts of companies, not understanding the local culture and then bombing, particularly with drinks, actually, when we really don't understand that context. So, Felicity, what's their next move?
So from January next year, 2026, Liquid Death is going into energy drinks, launching sparkling water that has caffeine and vitamins, but no sugar.
Well, that sounds more like it's a kind of brand position, brand equity is more congruent then. So a more authentic one. And if I can get that in, referencing authenticity, did I just do that? I think I did. See what I did there?
Yeah, our last episode. Okay. So I'm going to be interested in your thoughts on whether this next story is authentic or not. The Michelin Guide is now scoring wineries.
Ah, yes. So your next big recent story in drinks. That's been all over the news, hasn't it, in the drinks industry. Mm. So basically, the Michelin Guide has expanded its rating system from restaurants to now include wineries. So they're effectively applying the same system, but now to wine estates and production sites, except for instead of stars, they're using grapes. Do you think it took them a long time to come up with that? What symbol to use?
Yeah. Well, you know, the funny thing is they probably paid an ad agency a fortune to come up with that. So back in the days when I was an advertising creative, we got the account for this new tiered credit card and we spent ages upside down on the sofa and up against the wall trying to think of new names for it. So at one point we did astronomical names. We did sun, moon, I think there was nova and comet and asteroid and all sorts of things in there.
Oh, okay. So what did you choose in the end?
Gold, silver and bronze. Because that's all the client was comfortable with because they said that's all that customers understood.
Understood, yeah. Okay. Okay, so take us back to Michelin.
Okay, so basically what is the French tyre company that launched a restaurant guide? They're now hiring inspectors to go and look at wineries and they're going to rate the wineries using a grape system. One grape, two grape, three grapes.
Okay, that well-known system. You know the backstory on Michelin, of course you will because you're Felicity, that they basically came up with the restaurant guide as a way of encouraging people to get in their cars, drive more because they were going to the restaurants and then they need to change their tyres more often.
Yes, and from such funny little stories are great empires born.
Exactly, exactly. So the economic power of the Michelin Guide for restaurants can't be overstated. So once you get that 1, 2, or 3-star rating for your restaurant, your restaurant's effectively on the map and can attract overseas visitors coming just to visit your town, your region, just for the sake of getting to that Michelin star restaurant.
Yes, and I'll just do a little diversion from our main story. So the guide is so powerful that there have actually been two stories coming out recently about Australia and New Zealand. So the guide approached Australia in 2024 to talk about whether the country was interested in having an Australian edition of the Michelin restaurant guide.
Okay, so I've got a question here. I didn't know that countries or regions had to agree to Michelin to come into their country or region to get cover for their restaurants.
I know, it's interesting, isn't it? So I looked this up. So if you're what they think of as a newer region, like Florida or Texas, you absolutely have to pay to get Michelin to come out and do it, though it's done through the tourist boards. I couldn't find any evidence that what they call legacy cities like Paris have to.
Okay, so why didn't Australia say yes to having the Michelin guy come to their restaurants effectively and rate them?
Well, because of the cost. So Michelin wanted the equivalent of, in American dollars, $2.65 million to visit Australia in the first year, then about double the following year, and then ongoing millions per year. So Tourism Australia looked at it and just said no.
Okay, do you think they use the politest language as no? I'm not sure they are Australia after all, which means...
We do know grammar and punctuation. I'm sure they wrote them a pleasant enough letter.
A very polite letter saying
That's right. No.
Yes. Which means that the Michelin, I didn't know that, that's my naivety, is basically pay to play.
Well, yes and no. They're not living off the sale of their guide, but also them turning up doesn't guarantee a star. Though I imagine if they're going to go all the way across the world, they will give somebody a star. But anyway, here's the twist. They made the same offer to New Zealand, and this year New Zealand said yes.
For the same money that Australia said no?
No. Michelin offered New Zealand a rate that was way lower than the one they offered Australia, which could be because New Zealand is smaller, right? But that did not escape the notice of either country.
Oops, that is not a good thing to do. So I'm guessing there was outrage.
Yeah, there was. So significant sectors of the Australian restaurant trade were really angry that their government refused to cough up. Like the newspapers were full of it. While in New Zealand, the media was ablaze with people who were really angry that their government was funding luxury instead of social services.
Okay, so why do you think then that New Zealand did it and Australia didn't?
So I'm guessing because I've been to conferences in New Zealand, I know that they're really sort of disappointed and worried that nobody will make the trek to come and look at their incredible food culture.
Yeah,
but Australia, on the other
hand,
has been running international campaigns about gourmet tourism since 2013 with a huge payoff. So they probably felt they'd already done the hard yards and there were better ways to use the money.
Okay, so of course, so Michelin is regularly criticised also for imposing French dining values wherever they go, so valuing more sort of traditional formal dining experiences. I wonder how many restaurants they will find in New Zealand that match those values, because as you and I know from having the opportunity to travel there, the dining scene is different in its culture.
Yeah, that's right. Well, actually, this is where we get to the question of wine. So one area where Michelin has not been very strong has been their evaluation of restaurant wine lists.
Yeah, true. So you can have a sublime dining experience while the wine list leaves you cold, for example.
Yeah, because they basically don't evaluate it. So or it's not very important. So there's a Swedish entrepreneur called Christer Bengtsson who noticed this, and he set up a company called Star Wine List to tackle this problem.
Okay.
And he came up with this key insight, which is that restaurants that have outstanding wine lists always have outstanding food, but it doesn't work the other way around. So if you navigate by the wine list rather than by the menu, you're always guaranteed a great experience.
Okay, that's really true. I hadn't thought about that. So if I can't think of somewhere where the wine list has been outstanding that I've been to and the food has just kind of been average, which I guess raises the question as to why Michelin didn't just add wine list judging to their guides in the first place.
Okay, so this is me speculating, to be clear, but I suspect it's to do with their economic model, because how would they make money from wine lists?
Okay, so how does Star Wine List do it then?
So they get regions to sponsor awards, like the best Austrian wine list in Hong Kong, the best Austrian wine list in New York and so on. That's how they do it.
Yeah, which obviously Michelin can't do, because the moment they start monetizing wine lists through sponsorship, it would make them beholden to regions, and that would raise questions about whether regions were influencing the restaurants that got the award. So it sort of effectively killed the brand.
Yeah, that's right. And they can't judge individual wines because they bought a minority stake in Robert Parker's Wine Advocate back in 2017. So they don't want to compete with that.
Okay, so in any case, judging thousands of wines and then trying to sell a publication with the score and tasting notes is really hard work to do in a saturated market where there are many experts already doing that, established.
Yeah, so I want to make clear this is my opinion. I don't know this, all right? But yeah. I suspect the only sort of avenue that they had left was to judge wineries themselves.
Yeah, so and if Michelin goes to new regions and identifies great wineries, that could change the fortunes of those regions really quite significantly.
If that's what they do, yes, and maybe they'll do that in the future. But right now, they're starting with Bordeaux and Burgundy.
Okay, so the two regions that have been most classified and measured and discussed on Earth when it comes to wine. So the two regions effectively that need them the least.
Yeah, that's right. So if they, this is interesting, if they were to go beyond the classified growths in Bordeaux and they looked at the next tier, which is the Cru Bourgeois, that would be a game changer because that's the segment that offers amazing value, but which is, you know, experiencing a lot of economic stress right now.
I know how cynical you are, so I can predict you think they'll go to the top estates for a stint.
Yeah, that is my natural inclination, but obviously they're going to go wherever they're being paid by the region. So if the region of Bordeaux tells them to, maybe they will go out and discover some of the gems, but I'm not holding my breath.
Yeah, and this could be another one that we should return to next year to see what happens, perhaps.
Yeah, we can score them. We'll give them half a grape if they go from Bordeaux and Burgundy straight to Tuscany.
Okay, so we've got one more key drink story for 2025. Please tell me you've got something funny to send us into the new year, Felicity.
Oh, I do, I do.
Good.
Okay, Luli, what do you know about the Indian alcohol market?
Okay, phew. So I know a few things. You're right, it's a big story right now because it's one of the few markets where alcohol consumption is actually growing. But from what angle are you asking me that?
Well, just start with the economic overview.
Okay. So researchers are seeing it as a place with huge potential, as I was just saying. So ProVine India, the trade show held in Mumbai, said the market is going to reach nearly $40 billion by end of 2026.
Oh, that's next year. That's good news, isn't it?
Yeah, apparently so. So the report said, quote, Indian consumers are becoming more adventurous in their beverage choices, seeking authenticity. See, another person talked about authenticity in our episode, last episode. And they're seeking, still quoting, quality and variety.
Oh, my God. Can you hear me rolling my eyes? That sounds like
I can see
every
it,
report I've ever read about Gen Z. That's just generic descriptor.
Okay. How about this then? So it also says that sales channels are increasing with, quote, new formats like specialty liquor stores, boutique wine shops and upscale bars and lounges emerging. Also, it says the quality of wine bars is becoming world standard, with many ranked in the world's top 50.
Okay, that's good. Okay, anything else?
So from a consumer target market point of view, rising middle class, the growth curve is skewed towards younger, affluent urban demographics, which is good for alcohol consumption. We know younger populations typically lead to higher demand and more premium demand.
Right. Are there any downsides to this that you know about?
Yes. So a group called JM Financial Services says regulatory volatility is an issue. So basically meaning that, quote, state level taxation and excise policies remain unpredictable. I'm doing all the report reading here and the analysis, but this was a story you brought up. So what, have you got something, personal experience you want to get off your chest about the Indian market?
I've never been there, but my friend Alice Firing was there recently and she said all she could see were mass market brands slapped with, get this, 180% tax. So she said a bottle of Whispering Angel was the equivalent of $225 American dollars.
Wow, that is certainly a price tag, isn't it? And I have to say, none of this sounds very Christmassy, Felicity. You're going to end us on a good story. So why is your pick for a story of the year? What is it? And is it going to be fun?
Yes. Okay. Good. So I read in August a Wall Street Journal article that came out and it was called Think Doing Business in India is Hard. Try Getting a Drink After Work.
Okay, so don't tell me, is this going to undercut the India is the next big thing narrative I've just been talking about?
Okay, so India has 28 separate states and another 8 territories. The 8 territories are run by the central government, while the states all have their own governments.
Which inevitably leads to lots of different tax laws and legislation when it comes to alcohol consumption.
That's right. So some of these states have total prohibition. Mm-hmm. Others have got government-controlled retailers and some have got very liberal regimes.
All right. Why don't you tell us how hard it is to get a drink in some places in India then?
Okay. So this story is fantastic. It follows a 36-year-old banker called Ashutosh Singh, who has become wildly popular with just about everybody. He's contacted by dozens of people a week because he got a permit to enter the first bars in the western Indian state of Gujarat.
Okay, so you're telling me you need a permit to enter bars there?
Yeah, well, you're jumping ahead, Lulu. Okay. I'll continue. Yeah, okay. So he said more than 20 calls a week from strangers begging him for the right to tag along and go for a drink with him.
So do they buy the rounds then? Or if so, he's definitely onto something.
Well, you'd think, but hang on. So the state was the birthplace of Mahatma Gandhi, who was a non-drinker, and it had complete prohibition until very recently. But they have this special economic zone called Gift City.
What a name.
And it's been very successful in attracting companies like Google and Oracle.
So, of course, the government wanted effectively to make the foreigners working there happy.
That's right. So they saw in principle the need to make the place attractive to investors, basically.
So what, and only foreigners can drink that?
No. You can be Indian, but the problem is you have to have a permit.
So the Wall Street Journal says,
and I quote, only those working in Gift City can apply, and many are rejected by their employers or local officials who judge them too low ranking to wine and dine clients. About 700 permits have been issued, said a local official.
Okay, so too lowly to be wining and dining. It's a good thing that doesn't apply to those metrics where I live.
Yeah, I'd never get a drink. Okay, but there's a loophole, all right? You can get a permit if you're over 40 and if you can prove you need alcohol to treat a medical condition. So there's another guy in the feature that's called Raj Malhotra, and he spent an entire year collecting medical notes for medical records that document his hypertension, his heart problems, his sleeping problems, and his stress.
Okay, so is he now as popular as the first guy you mentioned?
It didn't say, but it said that now all of his friends are trying the same trick. And if they go to a doctor and don't get the certificate they need, they just go doctor shopping until they do.
Okay, so the obvious question, Felicity, is what health conditions qualify you to be able to get a permit to drink alcohol in bars?
Well, just about anything. As long as the doctor says you need alcohol to cure it, you can do sleep problems, stress.
Okay, so that's a twist on the wine and health debate we've been experiencing this year. So do foreigners then have to go through this same system?
Well, they can get a temporary 30-day permit, but people are quoted as saying it's more difficult than buying a house.
Okay, so by the time everyone has their permit, they must be like heading straight for the bar to start drinking.
Not so fast. There's another layer to this. So the few places where you can theoretically drink have security guards out the front who take your permit and write down your name. Okay. And then when you go inside, the places are monitored by CCTV that beams it directly into the police station.
Oh, my word.
And the places close at 11 p.m. and they don't put up signs anywhere, so they're really hard to find.
So it doesn't sound like much of a commitment to liberalising the laws, to be honest with you.
Aren't you glad we can just go to Lidl and buy gin and tonic in a can?
Yes, I'm glad we can go to a shop and buy what we want. No to Lidl. I'm picking up yours. Lidl gin and tonic in a can specifically. I would really struggle to do my drinks-themed Christmas trees with those restrictions in place.
And speaking of which, it is now time for us to log off and go and do holiday things.
It is absolutely. But before we go, can we just say a very big thank you to all of our wonderful listeners who sent us so much feedback and so many great questions. It definitely makes running a podcast so much easier if your listeners tell you what they want to hear.
Which is our way of saying send us more. Send them to aquestionofdrinks@gmail.com.
Yeah, and Felicity's New Year's resolution, she might not know this yet, for 2026, is that she's going to start doing her fair share of checking the inbox.
No. No, mine is to get a Bailey's sponsorship.
Okay, I approve on that one. I'll do the inbox, you do the sponsorship. And on that happy note, we wish everyone a happy and prosperous 2026. You've been listening to A Question of Drinks, the podcast that explores why we drink what we do.
And we're here to answer your questions. If you want to know more about anything drinks, from the marketing history to the economic underpinnings to why this drink is popular and not that one, send us an email.
Send us any questions you'd like us to discuss, and quite frankly, the more random and niche the better, and we'll have a go at answering them. We can be reached on aquestionofdrinks@gmail.com. That's aquestionofdrinks, all one word, @gmail.com.
And we would hugely appreciate you reviewing and rating this podcast before you go. 5 stars are much appreciated.